Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720.
Welcome to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 10 o'clock tonight. How about it, everybody? 3 days in a row. These all-star breaks happen more frequently, huh? 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We got a great show lined up tonight, all about language, poetry and performance, communication, language. That's what we're talking about on Extension 720. Milt would be proud. Great performers and great poets in studio tonight. Michael Warr will be here. Michael Warr is a longtime Chicagoan who ran the Guild Complex the first 10 years of its existence. The performance poet, I would say poetry organization, Chicago Poetry Organization, has been around for 30 years. Michael Warr went back to San Francisco. Boo! He was just here for a tour. For his new book of poetry and protest, which is really interesting. It's really a collection. It's kind of like an anthology, but it's a collection, a compilation of African-American poets from all around the country who are writing about social ills, in this case, police brutality. It really is a strong collection of artistic prose. And in it, he finds a way to not only make it about the work, and it could be new work, it could be edited work, it could be old work. He does a way to use photography and interviews with the poets and the poetry itself to create a great piece of work that not only lives on the page of this book, but it's also part of an art exhibit at the Stony Island Arts Bank on the south side of Chicago, running through August. So we'll have that conversation with Michael Warr. Also talk about the difference between living here in Chicago and San Francisco. Michael Warr, great Chicagoan in his time that he was here. Michael Warr coming up here on Extension 720. Also tonight, Avery R. Young, one of Chicago's greatest poets, I believe. This guy is everywhere. And he has been able to cross over from not just being a poet, but also a performer. He has taken performance poetry to a brand new level. He has his own band, a Deacon Board, which is a great band. He's really just sort of an extension of a rhythm and blues band. I mean, it's a tremendous band. They're in studio tonight. They'll perform live, and we'll also talk about his collection of poetry and his new album. He's got a new book called Neckbone. He's also got a new album called Tubman. So Avery R. Young will perform with the band and talk to us about his take on language. That's coming up throughout the program. Also, film director and writer Lulu Wong. This is exciting to have her in studio. Lulu's movie, The Farewell, is in theaters this weekend. It's getting a ton of great reviews. I looked it up. Everyone is saying this is the film of 2019. It is a tremendous film. I have to say, it's wonderful, but it's a story. It stars Awkwafina, and you know Awkwafina from Crazy Rich Asians, but she also is a comedian. She hosted Saturday Night Live not too long ago. This, you would think with Awkwafina at the helm, this would be a comedy. There are comedic elements, but this is a serious story about a matriarch in China. A grandmother who gets, goes to the doctor. The doctor tells her family that she has 6 months to live. And the family makes the choice to not tell the grandmother. And Awkwafina, she plays a woman who's, you know, a granddaughter who lives in New York. She lives in America. And she wants to come back. And she deals with the cultural implications of not telling her grandmother, not wanting to lie to her grandmother, but also wanting to honor what the family has chosen to let the grandmother live out her life. It is a personal story to Lulu Wong. It's her story. She put it on film, and she will be here tonight with us to talk about the film. So that's coming up as well. And then this amazing program here in Chicago, the Story Catchers Theater Company. Now, we talk about language tonight, but language is communication as well. And one of the issues, you know, we can talk about using performance and art as protests, like Michael Ward does and the poets in this book. But what Storycatchers does, they take the stories of teens from the South and West Sides, real teenagers who are living their lives. They are the members of Storycatchers Theater, and they do a program with the Chicago Police Department where they go into the Chicago Police Academy, and they tell their stories to cadets, because far too often those cadets become officers, and they will meet these teens on the streets in the South and West Sides of Chicago. And a lot of times it's the misunderstanding of who they are and how they interact that gets us to, you know, to read about it in the newspaper. And so the Storycatchers Theater Company goes into the Chicago Police Academy, and they role play, and they do theater, and they teach each other, both the cadets and the teens, about what their lives are like, so they better understand each other if they have to encounter them out in the real world. And I think that's a great program. We're going to talk about that tonight as well, looking to make a difference in those communities. So all that's coming up tonight on Extension 720. I have to say, it's a jam-packed show, Pete. Pete Zimmerman's here, as he is all week. He didn't get to take any time off. That's too bad. You're dragging today.
I am.
Three shows in a row, and I just don't know how we do it.
Another one tomorrow?
Another one tomorrow.
Oh, my God.
Programming note, I am in for Cochran, for Steve Cochran, tomorrow morning, too. Right. So I'm doing a quick turnaround. I'm also in for Steve for our big block party, WGN block party and parade out in Naperville, which is the big deal. That's a big thing the station's rallying around for Friday morning. But I will be in for Steve broadcasting live. And one of the coolest things, I will say this, to do this block party with WGN Morning News TV side, is that there's a parade. They're doing a parade at 9 o'clock right down the middle of Naperthrill, right there, right in...
Yeah, 53.
Yeah, right on 53. There, right? But they're doing a parade, and it'll be broadcast on TV. But I will get the opportunity to call a parade.
Are you serious?
Yeah, how cool is that?
This has been your dream. You've talked about doing the Thanksgiving Day parade on State Street for years.
I just feel like the art of parade play-by-play has gone by the wayside.
Yeah.
Radio play-by-play, where you can't see it. I have to describe everything to you.
Yeah.
The float, it's got little frayed edges. The wheels are brown. They're black. Let's look at their dancing. One's got blue. One's got red. I'm being great at it.
Yeah. Oh, this is exciting.
So that'll be Friday. And how amazing is that? Do radio play-by-play of a parade. The most visual thing you could possibly have. I will bring you a description of it. Dave Ennett, Mary Vandeveld.
Great.
Out there. This next one, it's a big float. It's large in life. It's a Dora the Explorer. Okay, Dora, how do I explain Dora? Okay, she's young. She's got a triangle-like haircut. She's got a backpack. And they are singing. Let's take a listen. Oh, we don't have the feed? Okay, they are singing.
you have to bone up on like facts, like when you watch the Macy's Thanksgiving parade or whatever. Al Roker is like, "Did you know you could put 1,000 cans of tomato soup in that float?" Like, what? Why would anybody do that?
I'm hoping Mike Heidemann's in my ear. You know, with that kind of information.
Oh, right.
You got to have an earpiece, right? I'm
getting
this right now. It's, you know, this float was actually built 16 hours ago, and they had to duct tape it together because it fell apart at the last minute. How about that?
It's always fun when you see a float in regular traffic, too. Like, you see one on I-55. It's funny. Just driving around.
That's so funny. I saw that after the Pride Parade.
Yeah.
I was somewhere, and there was a float trying to reverse or something. Like, beep, beep, beep. All the guys and the Speedos are just like, it's over. All right, so we've got a lot to do tonight, so let's get to it. We'll take our first break, and then when we come back, we'll get our first performance from Avery R. Young and the Deacon Board in studio. So stay with us. Extension 720 tonight, taking on language. Coming up after 7:30, Lulu Wong's going to join us, talk about her new film, The Farewell. Another part of that great film is just about Awkwafina, the character she plays. She doesn't speak the language. She has to go back. She goes back to her family in China. And being an immigrant who moved to New York at such a young age, she doesn't have all the traditional customs and cultures. So it's a really interesting life of being someone who shares the culture and shares the heritage, but doesn't understand it.
And that's a big, that's sort of like a secondary plot. Lulu Wang coming in studio to talk about, again, her personal story with that. But first, you know what we're going to do? Let's get our first song of the night from Avery R. Young and the Deacon Board. This is a great band. Avery R. Young, a great poet. He's got a new book out called Neckbone. He's got a new album out called Tubman. This guy can do it all, and he's doing it tonight in our performance studio. Avery R. Young and the Deacon Board. Here they are with the song Comb. Take it away.
1, 2, 3, go!
Young and the Deacon Board in studio, our performance studio, the song Comb, the album Tubman, the book of poetry, Neckbone. Is there anything Avery R. Young cannot do? We'll talk with him a little bit later in the show and get some more live music from him and his band here in Extension 720. Wow, love when he's here. Love it. Extension 720, Lulu Wang coming up next right after the news. What a beautiful night in Chicago. Impressive heat today, but it's supposed to go down to, geez, the 70s tomorrow? Play that funky music. Not that 70s. Temperatures. That's what I was doing there. It's amazing to look out as we broadcast in the 18th floor high atop the mouth of the Chicago River. I'm going to snap a photo and put it on my Instagram. You can follow me at Jay Coffs, also WGN Radio on Instagram. But you will see a tremendous view of all of the sailboats and the tour boats and everybody out here tonight as it is fireworks night in Chicago. So they're getting ready for the fireworks, and it's a beautiful night for it. All of that happening right behind us as we do radio, not just for the city of Chicago, but for the, what, 30-plus states that can hear this AM broadcast throughout the middle of this beautiful country?
I'm excited because when we were in Detroit, we were in Detroit on the 4th of July, and we were out, we're like, oh, let's go see some fireworks. So we went to this, like, bar area, and we're like, oh, yeah, this is perfect. We can see everything. All we did was hear fireworks.
That's like here.
No, we couldn't see anything.
Right here, where we're at, there's just a beautiful shot right down the lake to Navy Pier, but the fireworks are shot off just a bit south, and the Swiss Hotel blocks it. So you just hear it, and maybe you see a little trickle of green. Little trickle of pink, and then it's over, and you're like, "That was it."
Yeah. Well,
that's
all we get. Worst part about the fireworks,
it's a big
the loud
tease
noise.
It's like we get the boom, 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 boom. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the new film, The Farewell, is in select theaters this week. It tells the story of a Chinese-American woman who returns to China after discovering her grandmother was diagnosed with terminal cancer. The rub? The grandmother doesn't know about the diagnosis.
What's wrong, Dad? Please tell me.
Your nan is dying.
She doesn't know, so you can't say anything. The family thinks it's better not to tell her.
Why is that better?
Chinese people have saying, when people get cancer, they die.
We have to go to China.
Wedding is an excuse so everyone can see her.
He's not only cousin. Do you think I should be there?
You can't hide your emotions. If you go now, they will find out right away.
The Farewell tackles issues like cultural identity, family tradition, and shifting generational attitudes. Like, why is it okay to keep the truth from grandma? And if you were born in China but raised in America, can you ever go back? These are questions that Billy, the main character, takes on, who's played by Awkwafina. The film is written and directed by Lulu Wang. It's her story, a story that you may have heard on This American Life, but now the story comes alive on the big screen. Wang is most known for her indie film Posthumous. And like I said, The Farewell is in select theaters starting this week. Lulu Wang, my guest tonight on Extension 720. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So this story is a story that is obviously your story, and you've had a chance to tell it on This American Life. Why take it from that stage to film?
Well, actually, it started out as a film idea because I'm a filmmaker. Everything sort of has its genesis as a film. But it was hard to find the right partners to make the film the way that I wanted to make it. I found early in the process that people loved the idea but immediately wanted to change it and make it something else and make it broader, more marketable. And so, marketable in quotes. So then I set it aside, and when This American Life approached me to do a story, it kind of came up again, and I pitched it, and we did it through that. And it wasn't until after This American Life episode aired that all these producers called. And I sort of put me in the position of interviewing producers as opposed to the other way around.
It's a great thing to have, especially in Hollywood, to have that opportunity.
Absolutely, because that gave me the ability to choose the right producers for the projects, the one who had the same vision that I did and would fight to support my vision.
You mentioned about the marketable and people want to take the story in different directions. What I love about the film and the story is that it doesn't need the bells and whistles of a drama. The drama is innate. It's emotional. This idea that your grandmother is going through terminal illness and the fact that the family is keeping it from her is enough drama. There's enough to kind of play out. So I enjoyed that part of the film that it didn't feel like you needed to ramp up the conflict on every other page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's oftentimes when you're making a film or writing a screenplay, there are these rules, right? The first rule being you need a protagonist who's active and going for a goal, towards a goal and fighting for it. I don't have that. My protagonist, her action is inaction. You know, the goal she wants to have, she's not allowed to have.
Right.
So what do you do then? How do you sustain a story and keep the tension going? And people often want there to be these markers of like, this marks the midpoint and then this marks the climax. And that's just not how it is in real life. But to me, that real life is as dramatic, if not more dramatic, than a movie can be often. And so that's what I fought to do. In fact, in the second half of the movie, you learn pretty quickly that Awkwafina's character, Billy, is probably not going to give up the secret. Mm-hmm. That's not what it's about.
Right.
You're anticipating that maybe a little bit, but you can't sustain an entire movie about that. So much of the film for me in how to approach it was actually just about how do you say goodbye? And that can be such a dramatic and emotional question that I was just working to portray that cinematically.
It truly is. And it's a very thoughtful approach to the question at hand about whether or not you tell your grandmother that she is indeed dying.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about that, the struggle that Billy has to go through in the film by bouncing the idea off her parents, bouncing it off of the other parts of the family, but just also the internal struggle with her identity and understanding the culture that goes along with hoping someone has a peaceful death.
Yes.
That seems to me to be the crux of this film. The film that it's an internal struggle that Billy goes through to understand her culture, where she comes from.
Yes, absolutely. And I think on a subconscious level, it's also a way to avoid the thing she doesn't want to do, which is to say goodbye. And so by getting involved in all of these other questions and in a way like creating a fight, a struggle, it allows her to not look at the ultimate thing that she has to do, which is no matter what, at the end of the day, we have to say goodbye.
This is your story. How difficult is it to take your story from reality and put it on film?
It's definitely challenging in some ways and easier in other ways. Easier because I know the characters so well and I know the quirks and I know the things that make me smile and the things that make me want to scream. And so it was easy to find those things to put into the film to make it feel textured and lived in. What was challenging was figuring out where my responsibility lies, whether it's with the family that I love and respect and who I have to portray in a respectful way, or if it's to the work itself, where I have a responsibility to tell the truth and explore the story in a way that feels truthful, even if it may not make everyone look the way they want to.
Was that a struggle to do that? Because I would imagine that is the core of being a filmmaker who tells her own story.
Absolutely, because you never know how somebody sees themselves. They may not see themselves the way that you see them. And even before anyone saw the film in my family, I think there was just a lot of anxiety about, oh, wait, somebody's going to portray me? How do you see me? What are you going to put in there? You know, and there's a self-consciousness to it. And then you're like, well, what don't you want me to put in there? And they're like, well, what were you thinking of putting in there? And it becomes this weird dynamic. And I had my parents read the script pretty early on because I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't making assumptions, that they felt comfortable with what I was portraying. And my father had the funniest reaction because he read the script initially and he's like, okay, yeah, it's good. I said, well, does it feel real? And he's like, it feels very real, but why is it interesting? Why would anybody care about this? I was like, all right, don't have to worry about that. I'll leave that to me. At least he didn't think it was too, quote unquote, interesting.
Well, there's, you know, obviously when you're dealing with characters that are, you know, characters that are based on your family, they have issues. There's issues within the relationship with your mother and your father in the film, or Billy's mother and father in the film, just to how they interact with their parents and their siblings and all of that through that that is their story.
Mm-hmm.
I would assume that that would be difficult for you to be able to do it well, but it's like to be able to do that in a truthful way.
Yeah, definitely. And of course, you're exposing certain tensions within the family that's maybe never even talked about in the real family itself. So definitely, I think that was challenging and it's nerve-wracking for me to show the film to different family members because, you know, I have my parents, they saw it at Sundance, but then I have all this extended family, the aunt, my uncle, my cousin who lives in Japan, and I just don't know how they're going to respond to any of it.
Lulu Wong's my guest. She's the creator and director of the film The Farewell, which is in select theaters now. You know, another part of this film, and it's a big part of it, is the cultural identity of Billy, who is Chinese-American, born in China, moves at an early, early age to New York City, lives her life there, and then has to go back. That seems to be a big struggle for her about whether or not she belongs, where she belongs.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a story that really comes from your heart and from your story about trying to find your cultural identity when you straddle both worlds.
Yes. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, it's not so much like in real life, I never really considered that I would move back to China. But you start to realize that you constantly carry this lack with you everywhere that you go, this missing part of you. And, you know, there's almost two lives that I've led, the life that I led as a child with my whole family and then being ripped apart and coming to America. And all of a sudden, the love no longer feels unconditional, like Americans talk about unconditional familial love. And I joke with my friends who are Asian American, we're like, I don't think that the love from our parents is actually unconditional. It's very conditional, you know? And it's like you, because there's all this pressure that we did this for you, for you to have a better life. So everything that you choose to do or not do is reflects on that. And mm-hmm. whether or not you've made choices that have made your life worthwhile of their sacrifices.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a way, the relationship between Billy and her grandmother is the thing that represents the unconditional love before she was ripped away and put on this platform to perform and to represent the sacrifices of the family.
Absolutely. And also you recognize in the film that there is these biases or judgments on. There's a great scene at dinner where your character that plays your father and mother are going back and forth with a judgment fight with the family from Tokyo, just about, or the family from China, just this about, you know, whether or not it was the right thing to do to go to America,
mm-hmm.
or whether or not it's better to stay in China. And it seems like this push and this pull and this tug of war about who was right or who made the right choice with their lives.
Yeah, I think that no one really knows the answer for sure because we can only lead one life and every choice we make leads us to a number of other choices that take you further and further away from your initial path. And so that's one of the things that happens when you go back to your home country is everyone's made these different choices and you start to compare. And it's a way also for people to defend their own choices. And so they'll tell whatever stories they need to make themselves understand that I did make the right choice.
Right.
It's this self-assurance. And so that's what I find to be very interesting because it's all about perspective.
Yeah, and you know, it is a film that is very Chinese in the way that it is about the Chinese experience, whether it be in China or in New York City, the Chinese American experience versus China. But it is one that I think is universal and coming from any country, this idea of what you left and what you come back to.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's why, I mean, I grew up in this country looking at a lot of actors who don't look like me, but I was able to, you know, find myself in them and their experiences and their journeys. And so there's no reason why that doesn't work universally.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's what we set out to prove, that a specific story can be a universal story.
And at the end of the day, the cultural significance of not telling grandmother about her terminal illness.
Mm-hmm.
That was something that Billy, the character, the main character, who's based on you, had to grapple with, be on the straddle of that would not be acceptable in America,
mm-hmm.
but it's culturally relevant and traditional in China. When you were setting out to do this film, and now that it's done and you're making your ways through all the media and getting ready for it, do you feel like you've done a good job of explaining that traditional cultural divide, that we look at it one way here and someone might look at it somewhere a different way somewhere else?
I mean, I guess that's a question for the audience. That's certainly what I strive to do through the process, was to not make any kind of a particular judgment, because, to be honest, even to this day, I don't know what the right way is. I don't have answers. I don't know how I would want news like that to be handled for my own well-being. And it's a conversation that my parents and I still have regularly. And so at the end of the day, I think the movie for me is not about finding answers, but it is about exploring the world from perspectives that you may not have considered. And we're living in such polarized times that people from the same family, right, that you grew up in the same city, you were raised by these parents, and you may have completely opposing points of views. And so how do we live in this world, and how do we even love people and also accept that they may be different without trying to change them? And I think it takes a certain amount of grace, and that's what the film is about for me.
The film is called The Farewell. It's in select theaters this week. The writer-director, Lulu Wong, in studio tonight in Extension 720. Lulu, thanks so much for taking some time out to talk with us. We appreciate
Thank you for having me.
Continue our Extension 720 tonight, focusing on language, poetry performance, cultural divides, communication, stories surrounding, loosely surrounding that theme. We'll continue that coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. Michael Warr will be here. I've known Michael for a long time. Michael was the, he's a poet in Chicago. He actually grew up on the West Coast. He grew up in San Francisco. And he moved to Chicago, and I met him probably in the mid-90s. He was the first executive director at the Guild Complex, which was a poetry group organization that supported a lot of performance poetry. Really, if you really think about it, you know the movie Love Jones. A lot of the poetry performance or performance poetry scene here in Chicago came out of what Guild Complex was doing in the 90s. It then became sort of the impetus for that movie, but it also... I believe it trailblazed an area for a lot of young aspiring writers to perform their work, turn that work into poetry, into performance, into music. Chance the Rapper comes from that lineage. Other performers from that crew, from the Save Money crew, Vic Mensa and others, they all come from that same experience, which can be traced back to the forefathers in Chicago in the 90s, at least, would be Guild Complex. Michael Warr was the executive director at the time. He has, I guess you would say, produced this new book about protest and poetry and the history of it, specifically talking about poets and their take on the social ills of today, namely police brutality. Michael Warr, an African-American who spent a long time in Chicago, moved back to San Francisco, and a lot of the issues that are in San Francisco or in any big city in America are similar. So we'll talk with Michael about putting this book together, which now is an art exhibit as well at the Stony Island Arts Bank, the Esther Gates joint down on Stony Island. And just we'll talk about how he views things today. Michael Warr will be in studio coming up at 8 o'clock. And then also, I'm so excited, the Story Catchers Theater Company will be here. And this is a story I promoted earlier, that these kids tell their stories, and these kids from at-risk youth from the south and west sides of Chicago, they tell their stories, they turn it into theater, and for one specific program, they go to the Chicago Police Academy, and they tell their stories in theatrical, in the language of theater, to cadets, so they better understand where they're coming from, what their backstories are. They role play. The teens listen to the cadets get to tell their story, so that they have a better understanding of each other when they need to communicate, if they need to communicate, later in their lives. I think it's a great program. It's something that Story Catchers is doing. It caught the eye of Bright Promises, which is a long time. I think it's one of the longest, oldest philanthropic organizations in Chicago. They give grants to companies and to organizations working with at-risk youth. They'll be in studio as well. So it is a... I'm very excited to talk to them, and they're also one of the kids coming in is now one of the mentors or one of the apprentice teachers who had gone through the program and is now teaching other kids. So there's a lot there, and we'll have that conversation coming up after Michael in the 8 o'clock hour. And Avery R. Young and the band will be back as well. So we got lots to do tonight. So let's get to it. It's Extension 720. Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's been 30 years since the Guild Complex came to Chicago. And also, the first 10 years or so of that was run by the man in studio. He's back in Chicago, Michael Warr.
Good to be here, Michael.
It is great to see you, man.
Hey, it's good to see you, man.
It's been a long time.
I really see you as one of those people who helped us do what we do and get the word out there to the world.
Well,
appreciate that.
The Guild Complex and Michael, I've done so much for the poetry scene here in Chicago, and Michael is also the editor of the new book of poetry and protest, From Emmett Till to Trayvon Martin. It's a collection of poems from so many prominent African-American writers, just to name a few, Rita Dove, Angela Jackson, Tyamba Jess, a lot of Chicago names, Koresh Ali Lansana, Sonia Sanchez, and many more. This book is really about police brutality and about the issues that are facing African-Americans, African-American community. How did you get involved in this?
Oh, that's interesting. I was actually in Oxford, Mississippi, doing both a poetry reading for my book, The Armageddon of Funk, had just come out. So I was doing a book release party at Oxford. But I was also there as a consultant because I do organizational development consulting, and they were having some real issues with diversity at the time. So here I'm in the midst of this place with these two sides of my world going on, and I get a call from someone I didn't know, which was Phil Cushman. And Phil had read this anthology by Camille Bundy, I think her name is. I'll have to look that to make sure I get it right. Yeah. She's done this amazing book on black writers writing about the ecology. And he was so moved by it, he said he wanted to get her to edit this book he had in mind. And he called her and he said, you know, you should talk to Michael Warr.
Right.
You know, so I was out in San Francisco at the time where he lives. We both live there. Got together with him. And we just start working on this book. And, you know, the first 6 months of it was actually me setting up the photo shoots for the poets.
One of the things about this book, you know, because it's a collection of poems, and and some of them are new, some of them are old, but the concept really is to shine a light on police brutality. But you do it in a way that it's not just about the words on the page. It's not just about the poems. It's about the poets. It's about their bio. You put the photography you're talking about. That was on purpose. This wasn't just, you know, a layout from some publishing company.
Oh, no.
You wanted to almost highlight the humanity of it.
Yeah. Well, first of all, there was no publishing company. I mean, this guy decided he was going to put his money into this book, that it was such an issue that needed to be dealt with. I mean, this was in 2013 when we started this, you know, and so there were a lot of things bubbling up. All of it was really well thought out. That's kind of the reason I was brought into it. I basically was a producer of this book with Phil. And it was really important to him that we had these images of the poets. And he's a guy who has, you know, collect rock and roll signatures and sells them and posters and this type of thing. So we had a real connection to that. And he says, well, why can't poets get the same kind of attention that rock stars get? I'm like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. But at the core of it, what was happening in the streets at the time, and we went through a couple of renditions of the book. So to tell the story, we wanted to show the poets, and each one of them was asked to write what I called an I statement. Why did you start writing poetry? Why do you continue to write poetry? And how does that relate to this crisis that's going on in the country? And in some instances, I actually wrote their I statement because, you know, a lot of really busy people, but they had the final say and edit on it. But that was a core thing. And if your photograph was not in the book, you couldn't be in the book because that was part of
that
the format.
Part of the deal. When you talk about poetry and protest, you connect the two. You think of poets in the past. You say, yeah, they're essentially shining light on things that are happening in current events.
Right.
And maybe it's about war, or maybe it's about a social issue. When you think about the history of this, and you purposely call it From Emmett Till to Trayvon Martin, this has become an issue that for the African-American community, and I would say the American community as a whole, it continues to happen. Right. And it continues, and it's not just racism. It's just this idea that young black men and women are targeted more than other people.
Sure.
So you can really go back in time and see poetry that was done before this, obviously before this anthology, before this compilation, that are writing about the same thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Colin Kaepernick called it the new lynching, this killing of the unarmed. And when we were putting this book together in 2013, when this was just an idea, almost 35% of the shootings of that year were black people. And so my personal connection is this goes, of course, this was going on way before I was even born. But personally, I was born the same year as that Emmett Till was, you know, was killed. And I have this vivid memory of when I had just graduated from high school in San Francisco. This was a serious issue in the Bay Area. And the Black Panthers were passing papers outside of my high school, and there would be these headlines like, kill the pigs, right? Because there were these shootings going on. And I never forget that I had just graduated from high school, and I was at this bus stop. And I came across this officer with a magnum pulled on this kid who was like just a few years younger than me. Mm-hmm. And I had just graduated from high school, and his hand was shaking. And it's just a vivid image for me. And I kind of talk about in the introduction to this book of wishing for the day when people read about these incidents and they don't even understand it. They're like, how did that happen? Is that real? And so, unfortunately, it's an image that's been with us a long time, as you've said, and I don't see it going away anytime soon.
Well, artistically and creatively, poetry has done such a, I mean, it's been the art form that has been able to reflect and give insight to the human experience. Mm-hmm. And you think about it, that poetry is not going to necessarily fix the ills of the world, but they're going to shine a light, and that light can be pretty bright.
Yeah. Well, that's really important. And that was important to me putting this book together, is that I talk about this in the intro, that this is a tool in a toolbox of many tools. That's the way I want to approach it, that there has to be coordination and collaboration and a kind of interpenetration of all these different streams of reaction to this, and of its protest, but it's also spreading the word. It's also educating. It's also legislating. It's all these different things that have to happen. And one of the ways that's reflected in the book is that Reverend Barber is the last, you know, essay in the book, because he was out in the streets addressing this issue when we were putting this book together.
You know, I always want to say, well, you know, right now, 2019, you're seeing in Chicago, you've got a consent decree. They're reforming the police department after a series of issues, but also the shooting of Laquan McDonald. Mm-hmm. There seems to be a lot of heightened awareness, or at least an understanding of what's happening, to the point that society wants it to stop. Yeah. But then I'm like, I feel naive in that regard, because I feel like that probably should have happened in the 60s. It probably did happen. There were marches, and there were, like you mentioned, the Black mm-hmm. Panther movement, mm-hmm. the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and Rodney King. I mean, it feels like we've been here before.
Oh, exactly. And, you know, I think we do have to be aware of our naivety in our culture. The things that I was a foreign correspondent in Africa, you know, in my 20s in Ethiopia, and there was a revolution. And there were, you know, like, we don't run into agents typically, or even the military in our daily lives. But living in a place like that, I was constantly mixing it up with revolutionaries, counter-revolutionaries, agents. The CIA tried to recruit me. The KGB tried to recruit me. I mean, these are things that really go on in the world. So I think that, one, we need to recognize that we do have a degree of naivety, but also disbelief if it doesn't happen to us. And so when this couple was, you know, run up on in Phoenix a couple of weeks ago with their 4-year-old child who had taken a doll out of the store that wasn't even worth $5. These types of incidents, they actually lead to death often. I mean, I have a long poem about this that names the incident, what precipitated it. And most of the time, it's some simple thing that's about nothing, and it escalates into a crime. And so when I saw that incident in Phoenix, one of my first thoughts was the presidential candidates need to be asked about this. So Buttigieg, you know, he's had to address this issue. And I think it's great that he's having to address it, because it's on the national scale. If it wasn't for him being a presidential candidate,
I don't know if we'd be talking about it.
I mean, first of all, that issue was nothing. It wasn't, the discussion of it was precipitated by something new, but it had happened in the past. It's all about something that happened before.
And even worse, you're in San Francisco on the West Coast, but in Chicago, no one was paying attention to South Bend, and it's right next door.
Exactly.
So, yeah, you're absolutely right. Michael Warr, my guest, a longtime poet and author and editor, his new book that he helped produce, as we say, of poetry and protest, from Emmett Till to Trayvon Martin. Let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about the 30th anniversary of the Guild Complex.
Okay.
Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. My guest in studio, Michael Warr, longtime Chicagoan, who I just found out isn't from Chicago. I always thought you were from here.
Exactly.
And then you
Most
went out to the West Coast and you're back, but you're from San Francisco. He is the poetry editor of A Poetry and Protest from Emmett Till to Trayvon Martin, the new book that is out now, which sold out its first printing. Mm-hmm. Congratulations. It also has a corresponding or a ancillary exhibit at the Stony Island Arts Bank, which is on the south side. It's a great place, the Astor Gates place, but there's an exhibit based on the book that's on Stony Island. That's great.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this because I like mixing poetry up, right? I mean, we live in a time where everything can be mixed, right? And so I was deputy director at the Museum of the African Diaspora in San Francisco. And so I have this love for working with museums, and it's very rare, you know, where there is a exhibit of art and photography from a book of poetry.
Right.
So I'm thrilled with this collaboration that the Guild is having with the Rebuild Foundation, you know, and it's really worth seeing, and fortunately it's going to be there throughout the entire summer.
All right, so go check it out there in Stony Island Arts Bank. All right, 30 years to be back in Chicago, just had a bunch of celebrations for the Guild. We had Julie and Andrian talking about Printer's Row. They did the power lines, 20th anniversary. For you to look back and celebrate the 30th anniversary of the Guild Complex, what's that mean to you?
You know, you have to kind of say that you got something done, right? Because the mission of the Guild was really about mixing communities, bringing people together under one roof. You know, the whole question of diversity before it became something that everyone was talking about. And I was in a program recently where I was just mentioning how many well-known, established poets have passed through the complex.
Oh my gosh,
and,
yeah, right.
You know, some of them Pulitzer Prize winners, many of them doing great things out in the world. You know, a lot of times people connect me to that. And I would say, well, the poets did that. I don't claim any responsibility for that. They did what they had to do to be successful. But what I will claim is that the Guild was paying attention. I made this point that the Guild was born woke, you know, and so it's, we did have this impact and continue to have this impact of trying to transform our condition, you know, and that's the way to do that is through the arts connecting people.
You know, it's too cliche to say it gave voice to the voiceless because the poets that you've worked with.
But it's true.
What I love about it is it brought together and continues to bring together poets and writers and creative types from different neighborhoods, different backgrounds, different genres and different races.
Yeah.
And I feel like that has gone a long way to the idea that diversity is not something that is mandatory, but it's something that it just should be, that makes sense.
Right? Yeah, and you have to work at it. This is kind of connected to this thing about naivety, too, is that if you don't do something to make it happen, most of the time it's not going to happen. Because I remember people used to kind of look askance at me because when we were organizing, for instance, the Neutral Turf Poetry Festival with Navy Pier, I would literally count how many women, how many people from this community, from that community, how many people from LGBT. I mean, because you had to do that, otherwise it wasn't going to happen. And then once you start doing it, it becomes more natural, at least within, you know, certain parts of our society where you don't have to be counting those numbers anymore, but somebody has to kick it off by counting.
I always think, Michael, and one of the things, you know, even out of Chicago from 2007, the live lit storytelling scene here in Chicago is blown up beyond what the Guild was doing. But now, I mean, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
But you will hear and you get this sense from people that a lot of the storytellers who may put it up on stage in the North Side or maybe out in Logan Square or somewhere else, they're not necessarily concerned about bringing in people from the South Side or bringing in storytellers from the West Side.
Sure.
That there seems to be almost this way that there's these factions or lack of diversity when, you know, it was built on diversity. How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, first of all, the more the merrier, right? So the thing is that everyone doesn't have to do the same thing. So if you look at diversity from the standpoint of all of those different people that you're referring to and the venues and the organizers that's doing something different, that's a form of diversity, right?
Right.
And so if you lose the places that are really kind of committed to that and concentrating on it, first of all, the fact that we have organizations and venues that are doing that naturally, it's kind of built into their DNA, it relieves the need for other organizations to do it. And so that's why collaboration between different institutions is critical. And the Guild is always organized with large institutions, was organizing with museums. We had my 10th anniversary going away party was at the Historical Society. So, but also organizing with neighborhood groups and that type of thing. So I feel really proud of the fact that we contributed to where that level of interaction between different communities and different art forms exist. And Teachers Press, you know, which was the publishing wing of the Guild Complex for many years, reflected that in the publishing as well. And you can see things that exist today that are just commonplace that were not if you go back 30 years.
I also think there's similar cities in San Francisco and Chicago in the way that I always thought the Guild Complex introduced me as a young Chicagoan to a world of art and artists and creatives who were doing things that I didn't know were happening. And so events that were happening, whether it be in Wicker Park or on the south side of Chicago, you got to see this stuff and you got to see people expressing themselves. And
up close.
It was inspiring. It was inspiring. Yeah. I would think with San Francisco similar, that as the American city changes and it gentrifies full over, just look at Chicago where we're sitting, all these high rises around our studio are luxury condos and things of that nature. Is there a place for artists and creatives in these big cities? And is there a place for them to be able to afford to inspire people?
Well, there is a need. There's no question about it. Now, San Francisco is a good example because, for instance, the black population has fallen from I don't know, at least 16% at some point to like 4% now. And a lot of creatives who could no longer afford to San Francisco would move to Oakland. And now Oakland has one of the highest rents in the country. So people complain often that the kind of culture that's associated with San Francisco that drew so many people there is dying on the vine. So organizations that are dedicated to maintaining, you know, that diversity are critical, but it is difficult to maintain. So I think that we have to also find new creative ways of sustaining both the artists and the organizations. And so I'm really committed to that. I know I'm no longer the director at the Guild and haven't been since 1999. But when you look at those photographs of the 30 writers to watch, it so succinctly represents the mission of the organization and what we need. We need that mix.
Michael Ward, great to see you, man.
Hey, it's good
always,
to see you.
Always a pleasure to talk with you, the longtime Chicagoan who's back home in San Francisco. He is the poetry editor of Poetry and Protest, from Emmett Till to Trayvon Martin, the book that is out now. It's also a corresponding exhibit at the Stony Island Arts Bank. The book, congratulations, already sold out in its first print.
And reprinted.
And reprinted. Yeah. So there you go. And the 30th anniversary of the Guild Complex. Michael, I can't thank you enough for stopping by.
Hey,
and,
thanks for inviting
me. Can't wait to have you back.
Great. Thanks.
Yeah. All right. Story catches in the building.
Who, what, and why? Who, what, and why? Who, what, and why? Who, what, and why? Who, we are catching stories. What, you changing our community? Why, cause the real power lies in my choice. I got one more chance, I'ma change my voice.
Look, Story Catchers is a place to be, where we got a good family and community, and we all is a unity.
Cause today the way it's looking, it ain't just you and me. It takes a village to raise a child. Let's put the guns down, make our mothers and our families proud. Make our mothers and our families proud.
Yeah.
Make our mothers and our families proud.
Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. That's a song from the Story Catchers Theater Ensemble. Great song, talking about what they do. Well, from Michael Ward's book that we just heard to our next segment, the words on the page can be a huge tool for helping people understand each other, but Story Catchers Theater takes it even further. The theater company works with youth from Chicago's South and West Sides to tell their stories, but it's who they're telling their stories to that make this company stand out. One of the programs takes teens from the community to the Chicago Police Academy so that cadets can better understand the backstories of the youth they one day may encounter on the beat. And in doing so, both the kids and the cops find a shared language. This is just one of the programs offered by Story Catchers. They do workshops, they work with kids in juvenile detention, and they do traditional theater shows too. All of it is why Bright Promises, one of Chicago's oldest philanthropic organizations, supports Story Catchers. Bright Promises is a not-for-profit that gives grants to organizations helping at-risk youth in Chicago. In studio to talk about Story Catchers are Priya Shah. Priya is the executive director of Story Catchers. Also, Jacob Klinkscales, an apprentice teaching artist who found the theater company when he was a teenager growing up on the South Side, and from Bright Promises, Catherine Corey. Priya, let me start with you. The Story Catchers, it's been around for decades now. But, you know, for you, why join this organization? And tell us what you think Story Catchers does best.
Story Catchers works with young people who are in and out of juvenile justice system or in and out of justice system, and guides them to transform their real life experiences into powerful musical theater. And in doing so, really, they are working with the young people to own their personal narratives and see themselves as strong, resilient people with agency and adaptability and coping skills. And they are also owning their narratives to be leaders and mentors in their communities.
Jacob, let me ask you about that. They have owned their own narrative. What's that mean to you?
Right. To own your own narrative, that means to embrace your story, the good parts of it, the bad parts of it, and to take that story and see how we can make light of it. Because within the good, the bad, the ugly, there's always something that we can learn from our trials and tribulations. So what we do as Story Catchers is taking this story and making it beautiful. And once we're able to put music to it and put it on stage, we're always able to find the light in it and find different parts of the story where we would have wanted to make better decisions and look at a more positive outlook.
Take us through some of the stories, because I would assume that you're getting reticence from some people who don't necessarily want to tell their story because they may not be proud of what they've done or who they are.
Right.
How do you draw it out to tell their story in a real way?
That's a lot to ask somebody to, you know, to pour their heart out or write something vulnerable about themselves. But we always start with a theme. And all the stories have the same theme. So our theme this year is trust, double lives, secrets, having to, you know, put on facades. We start as a group. We always make sure that everybody's feeling welcome, everybody's feeling comfortable with each other. Because if you're comfortable with the people in the room, then you're more willing to speak out and share more parts of yourselves that you wouldn't normally share with each other. So my job as a teaching artist and my job as a peer is to help them feel welcome by telling my story. So I tell them about how I've come through the program and how I share my story about how I've gone through a lot of things in my life where I put myself in danger and how I may have went on the wrong path, but I was able to find my way to the right side of life. And so once people see you take that leap of faith and see you making strides to do better, they say, hey, I can do that too. So we just create the right environment, a safe space for people to open up, for people to feel comfortable.
Now, you're a success story in the way that you came through Story Catchers and then you become a teaching artist with Story Catchers.
Right.
When you first came to the program, what was your story? What did you think your story was?
So I didn't really think I had a story. When I joined Story Catchers, I didn't know we had to write true stories. I wanted to write a story about, you know, something fictional. But they told me that we had to write true stories, and I wasn't used to sharing.
You're like,
about
what? I don't want to do that.
Yeah. Like, my mom, she signed me up for Story Catchers. I didn't know what exactly I was getting myself into. But I realized that I was going to have to talk about myself. And my story was the first story I ended up writing was a story about my mom. And I lost my mom when I was 11 years old. And that was really hard for me because I had to move around a lot. And I was just really unstable and just learning how to find myself. But I was able to tell the story of good memories I had with my mom, and that helped me become more open. And because other people, they began to share their stories about people they lost in their lives. And once I got done telling the story of my mom passing away, I was like, okay, well, I can get deeper in that. I can tell, I don't just have to share one layer of my life. I can tell about how I was at risk of being in a gang with my older brother. You know, we grew up on the west side of Chicago. Really, that's all I saw. So I was somebody who stayed in the house, but my brother, he was out in the street, so he would, you know, teach me the gang handshakes. And 10, 11 years old, I already knew, like, how to shake up, like, four corner hustlers. So if I continued on that route, I could have been out in the streets. But luckily, I found an outlet and I found something that I was really passionate about, which was telling stories, which was writing, which was being on stage. And that's helped me be on the right track.
Catherine, I wanted to bring you in here because with Bright Promises, this is what you do. You get groups like Story Catchers to you fund them, you develop them, you help, you become partners with them. When you hear the story, this kind of backs up the idea of why you guys are involved with Story Catchers.
Absolutely. You know, I'm over here just beaming with pride because it is the voices of youth leaders just like Jacob that we are so excited to be lifting up as part of our 150th anniversary. We've had the pleasure since 1869 of getting to experience firsthand that Chicago is filled with creative, ambitious, resilient, amazing youth. And we really wanted to help flip the narrative. We wanted to help to show more people all the good things that young people are doing in our communities and the incredible impact that they're having in their own lives, in their families, and in their community at large.
Well, let me ask you, because there's a lot of ways to spend money to deal with some of the issues that Chicago's facing, whether it be gun violence or poverty or inequality and down the line. Why invest this way? Why go and give money to creative organizations or to arts organizations who are doing great things, but why do that instead of putting the money elsewhere?
So Bright Promises Foundation really believes in addressing those urgent unmet needs. And we seek out those spaces that other funders aren't in, either because they don't know about them or because they haven't prioritized them. And we really make it our goal and our priority to create a movement, to create a lot of awareness and to move the needle in that space so that there's more organizations leading those programs and services. And so that we start out as maybe the only funder funding these organizations, but by the end of our partnership with them, we're definitely not the only funder funding these organizations.
Do you see a direct correlation when you talk about the money that you're investing in communities to solving some of these issues? Do you see it that way, that if you become a lead donor who helps and gets other people involved, that you will see an impact in some of these communities?
The impact is so real. We really like to look at this as starting to unravel these really complicated and complex issues that our young people are facing. It's not a single problem with a single solution that we can address. And in that way, Bright Promises Foundation recognizes that we cannot do it alone. We have to partner with these organizations. We have to partner with our young people, with our parents, with our community advocates, and with our political leaders, because we have to all be working together to be able to create the bright future that our young people really deserve.
Priya, let me bring you in here. One of the things that we want to talk about, and it's such an interesting way to use stories and narratives, is the initiative to work with the Chicago police and police recruits to let people from Story Catchers let the police recruits understand better where these kids are coming from, with their own stories, so that they better understand when they're out and doing their job and they have a better understanding of who's in the community. Where does this come from? Where's this idea come from?
Since June 2017, Story Catchers and Chicago Police Department have collaborated to bring the voices of young people and to train new recruits on empathy and cultural awareness. We all know that there's deep mistrust between Black and Brown communities of Chicago and CPD. Mm-hmm. And the young people we work with are sometimes scared and triggered by officers, and they shouldn't be. All of the communities should feel safe, not just a few. So what we do with our programming is we get seemingly opposing groups of youth and recruits, these new recruits, together in an environment which is a safe space. It's a reflective environment to talk about instances and conflicted instances on the streets. Mm-hmm. So we role play out a story of one of our youth. It's a real life story of a pullover gone wrong. And then the recruits and the youth actually role play out both sides to understand both sides, to have constructive conversation and a dialogue about what happened, what went wrong, and really talking about how could that situation have changed to make it safer for both CPD recruits and for the youth. And through that, the recruits that actually are going to patrol on the streets in the future understand the Story Catchers youth in a reflective environment. They know what relationship they need to build with the youth. They know what relationship they need to build with the communities. there are power structures in play here, you know, and how do we give that environment to our communities, to our youth, to feel safe in that power structure and to have those conversations.
And what's great about it, and I think why this is such an intriguing story, is that far too often both sides seem to work in stereotypes about what they think this youth is thinking or what this police officer is thinking. And to have an opportunity to break that down and to actually have a conversation around it, I mean, it almost feels priceless.
Yeah, it is. It's about humanizing. It's about understanding each other's perspective. It's about understanding the other person on the person on the other side is actually a human with a story, with a life, and a small action could actually have very drastic consequences. So how do we give that environment?
When you think about this and involved with that, how important is this for story catchers, but also for the Chicago police?
Right, I would say it's very important, and if we really want to make a shift within our city, within the power structures that come in play when we talk about everything that has transpired between the police officers and the community. And it's been really good to see the different interactions we've been having with the police officers, because you get to see them at the human level. You get to see them. They have on their uniform, but we get to know them as individuals a little bit. So when we're doing the role play, they actually step in the shoes as the youth. In this traffic stop, they get pulled out of the car. They get handcuffed. They get put to the ground, you know, and we have a conversation about that. And we say, you know, how did that make you feel? And they say, well, I was scared. I didn't know what to do. I feel like I didn't have any power. That was traumatized. You know, that triggered me. We're like, yes, these are the conversations we need to be having, because that's exactly how a lot of young black men and women are feeling once we get pulled over by the police officers. You know, just feel like we're being stereotyped. So when they open up that conversation, they're able to see, okay, I don't want to make anybody feel that way. So what can I do? How can I use my training? How can I do my job without overexerting my power? And how can I do my job with understanding that this is an individual who has a story, who has trauma, and just respecting each other? Because that's what we're really missing, the respect value. Like, in my community, we don't want to see the police. We don't want to see them riding past. We don't want to see them standing on the block, whether that be in front of a school, in front of the liquor store, or, you know, riding past somebody's house, because we just know what comes at the police. We know, we feel like they're going to be out to get somebody. That's what it's like.
Are you learning, though, that the stereotype goes both ways?
I'm learning that the stereotype goes both ways, because just like as we see them in the uniform, a lot of times they just see us as somebody. And I don't want to generalize, but a lot of times they just see us somebody as black, not looking at us as individuals. Mm-hmm. So once we get to know each other on the individual level, right, we can build that trust, we can build that respect. But it all starts with having the conversation. And so that's why we're having these healthy spaces, these safe spaces, where we can have constructive conversations and be honest about how we're feeling and be honest about the current state and looking towards positive outlooks.
Priya, we've heard the word trust thrown around and respect as well. From your perch at the executive director role, are you learning as well alongside these kids? I mean, are you learning more about some of the issues that are facing not just the community that come to Story Catchers, but the police and everyone in between? It feels like there's this moment here where, because everybody seems to be stripping this stuff away, that there is this learning opportunity for all.
Absolutely. The learning has been tremendous. So, I mean, if you think about young people coming to Story Catchers, the first thing we do is give a safe space, because they're coming in with very, very challenging environment. They come in with the trauma. What we have to do is give them that space, safe space, so that they can build that trust with our staff, with the other youth, as a community, so that they can share their stories. Because really, it's about how do you process what you've been through to be able to tell your stories and then use it as a validation so that you can actually build yourself and build your narrative, right? And with the institutions, one thing that we've learned is that it really is about having a dialogue. It's about understanding how can we all be at the same level playing field. It's about how do we break down the barriers? How do we break down the power structures? And really have a dialogue on how are we going to make our community and society a better space and a safe space for all.
Priya Shah is the executive director of Story Catchers Theater. Jacob Klingscales is apprentice teaching artist with Story Catchers. And Catherine Khoury is with Bright Promises Story Catcher Theater. You can find them online. A great program doing wonders for communication between communities and police here in Chicago. More to come on Extension 720, so stay with us. Thanks, Don. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, we save our best for last tonight. Avery R. Young, poet and performer and musician, everything in between. It's a new book out, Neckbone, new album, Tubman. The band is in the performance studio, the Deacon, it's Avery R. Young and the Deacon Board. And here they are with the title track from the new album. Take it.
7, 1, 2, 3, and 8. This one right here. Call Tubman, period. Hold my mill, hand me my hammer, me to smite or bell. I call her double entendre. Run with me. Get out of my way. I'd rather meet my maker than be in bondage another day.
Chorus.
I'm reaching for my tomato. Call me Moses. I'm the new lawgiver. Yeah, I'm reaching for my tomato, crooked footed, but I'm a deliverer.
Second verse, y'all.
Hold my mail, give me room. Sport or to be a wide word, a bride. Ready for her groan. Buck with me, hey. Oh, sit yourself down. We ain't got long to be here, so I'm gonna shout right now. Oh, yes, I am. Of course, I'm reaching for my. Took me, call me Moses. I'm a new lawgiver.
Hey,
I'm reaching for my took me, crooked footed, but I'm a deliverer. Oh, oh, look at here. Oh, look at here. My Lord, look at here.
To the top, y'all.
I'm the guilty, crooked footed, eye child. Lord, wait a minute, work the MD. Crooked footed, eye child. Don't think they heard me say MD. Crooked footed, eye child. Don't think they heard me say MD. Crooked footed, eye child, y'all. Name blacker than me, yeah. Oh, oh. Yeah, ain't name blacker. Hey, hey, name blacker than me, yeah. Blacker
than me. Them blacker, blacker than me. Them blacker than me. Them blacker, blacker than me. Them 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 blacker than me.
Yeah! Yeah, there you go. Avery R. Young, the Deacon Board, in studio, the performance studio, that song Tubman, the title track, the new album out by Avery and the band. He also has a collection of poetry out, Neckbone. We're going to talk about that. We'll take a break. We'll get Avery to the chair, and we'll continue the conversation here on Extension 720. Yeah! Welcome back to Extension 720, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio tonight, Avery R. Young, prolific poet, and his new book of poetry is out. It's called Neckbone. And he also, of course, as we just heard, is the frontman for Avery R. Young and the Deacon Board. The new album is called Tubman, and it is out now and wherever you get albums. It's great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me. It's great to see you, too.
What possessed you? I know you are such a creative guy, and we've had you on before, but what possessed you to do both a book and an album at the same time?
Wow. Well, the book and the album is in service of each other. So the idea is that the album, Tubman, is the soundtrack for the book, Neckbone. That is the original thought behind having a book and a record out at the same time. The issue right now is books and records are totally two different entities. You know, even in the context of a movie or a soundtrack for a movie, which was my thought, right? Movies
right.
have soundtracks. I'm going to have a soundtrack for my book. You know, even in the context of that, it's still two separate entities. But this
is
usually, you know, a movie is made by one person and the soundtrack is made by another. This is the weird thing. I did both.
You did both.
Well, I did both.
It makes a lot of sense, especially on paper, because you as a poet and a musician and an educator, you work with words. That is what you do. So it's not surprising you're prolific enough to do both.
Yes.
When you say it's a soundtrack for the book, how do they interact?
So the interaction of the book and of the records, the songs are to extend specific poems in the book and also ideas that the book brings up. So Neckbone really is about how this person, being me, learned to navigate through adjectives that a lot of people may consider to be, that a lot of people not necessarily value. And so the poems in the book are about me navigating that.
Mm-hmm.
And so my idea with the music was to create the music that were inside those moments.
Mm.
Just the thought of like the movie, when you see a movie and you see a scene and then there's the song playing behind. And that's exactly what I'm like, what is playing in the background in this particular moment or this particular poem? So that was the idea.
I know that and we've talked about this before, but you as a poet, and I know that you look up to, inspired by Gil Scott-Heron and others like that, who were poets who put their words to music.
Yes.
You do that.
Yes.
But if you listen to the performances, this is not reading poetry over, you know, over some drums, right?
No,
this
not,
is
at
a
all.
Full
not at all.
Performance.
Not
you would not know that the music that you're producing with the band is based on poetry.
Wow. Thank you. For me though, it's all poetry. Even Respect, Aretha Franklin or Otis Redding, Respect is a poem, you know, set to music, or it's just language set to music. I think as a poet, I have more of a concern, a way in which the music services the words as opposed to the way in which the words fit in to the groove. But I just think that's the only difference. I still understand music to be a material of vibration, and people still supposed to feel and rock with it, you know, not necessarily sit down and go, oh, that metaphor.
there's something about your poetry, too, though, and and you've been at the forefront of this, that, yes, we're going to sit down and listen to you read a poem or or perform live in that form. It's never a poetry reading. No. It is a performance. And it is. When you say about the music vibrating, and that happens when you're just reading the poems themselves. There's, it's not a moment where you're not into the words, that you're not feeling the words. Where do you think that comes from?
That really comes from me sitting down and being involved, well, just being immersed in the culture of, I will say, Baptist church. I've never seen anybody orate language and it just be somebody reading from a book every time. Every time I've seen someone orate or speak words, it's always been in the midst of vibrations, and it's always been performance. It's always been kind of like this call and response. The expectation of the audience was never just to sit back and hear something. The expectation for the audience is to participate in the messages that's being communicated. So that's where all that comes from. Yeah. Just been staring at preachers all my life, and also being a lover of the blues and seeing that same thing. You people don't go to a blues place and just sit down and just go, oh, okay, you know, that's
let me
that's
listen to this
for.
let me
listen to this. You know, the language is supposed to strike a chord within you, you know, and which will cause you to respond to something. So that's where all of that comes from.
You said the word expectation, and I think about you as a poet, and there's an expectation for what a poet is or what poetry is, and you seem to defy that in the way that you push back on what poetry can do or what poetry is. Why do that? Why try to break what people know of the art form?
One of the reasons why I'm so adamant about changing the way in which people think and look at poems is because I feel like poetry may have disserviced itself by becoming so academic, right? And so that is intimidating.
Right.
But most babies learn language based upon poetry. Like, you know, I learned the alphabet because it was presented as a poem, right? It was presented in the letters of rhyme. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P.
Right.
You know,
that
becomes a poem. That's a poem right there. And that's just people simply learning alphabet, you know? And so I challenge myself with each poem, especially with this book, Neck Bone, and with the music from Tubman, is that, man, this can only come out of my hand. So I have to do it in a way that can't nobody else do it. So that's how I challenge myself. That's where I, because really to me, poetry is about the blessings of the individual, right? It is anybody truly can write and express a moment in time that they've experienced or that they have witnessed and even researched, right? But what about you makes it a recording that only you can do, right? So you and I right now can look out in this window and write a poem about the cars that are crossing the bridge. You know, my challenge to myself is to make sure you can't write what I write about.
That's a great point. I know I can't write like you, but Avery R. Young's my guest. Deacon Board is in studio as well. We're going to hear some more live music, but you know, as you evolve as an artist, and we had you in here in the download not too long ago, a couple years ago now, but this idea that you continue to push yourself with these dual projects, what are you trying to achieve as an artist? What is it at the end of the day? Are you looking for mass appeal? Are you looking for what is it about these projects that makes you tick?
The thing about these projects that makes me tick is the idea of documentation. You know, Idris Goodwin is a poet, playwright, musician, rapper, and he has, years ago, he had a song, and the hook of the song is, if you don't document it, it never happened, right? So, essentially, my work in art and presenting the arts and in the many disciplines that I presented in is really just to say I happened. Like, at some point in life, at some point in the world, at some point in history, you know, I showed up, right? And I had this perspective on the way I grew up, the way in which black body is viewed, the way black culture is presented. I had some thought about that. And so that is the main purpose. Now, when you have the idea of commodifying that, right? You put it in a book, the book is supposed to be sold.
Right.
You make it an album, the album's supposed to be sold. Right? It is really at this point about getting that book and getting that record. It is in the many homes because the record, for me, feels good, right? And the book is beautiful. It's a book that belongs on a coffee table and starts conversation. And a lot of the work in a book really is really specific to Black identity, queer identity, male identity. I think it reaches beyond those adjectives and applies to anybody who just dares to be themselves, you know? And so that's the main goal now is to really get as many people exposed to this idea that they can actually be themselves. They can actually, the music envision a soundtrack to your own life, which is what Tubman is, you know, soundtrack to this life I had. Cause it was crazy thing was when I wrote the book, my thing was, oh, I'm going to pick like 28 things that happened to Black people that kind of really explains Black thought in like today. And then when I was like, this is about me.
Yeah, right?
This is about me. I'm like, oh my goodness. I didn't know I was going to write about me as much as I did, you know.
It's a good subject. It's a good topic, right?
Hey, it's one I know very well.
And Chicago does too. Yes. Avery R. Young, one of the best poets, writers, and musicians in town. And the book is called Neckbone. It's out now. And the album as well is out, Tubman, which is coming out in the middle of the month here.
Yes.
Avery, great to see you.
Great to
and,
see you.
And thanks for coming in, bringing the band and performing. Appreciate it. Great to talk with Avery R. Young again. Got one more song with him after the news. How about that? We'll get one from, and then we'll give you an update on Alligator Gate. Nothing really to report. It's actually, I can update you now that the Alligator Bob, I think, is done for the night. And they, the Humble Park Lagoon, it's actually really interesting. A salsa band showed up, serenaded everybody in the lagoon promenade, and all the people there had a beautiful summer night as they all cheered on the alligator at the Humble Park Lagoon. It's kind of puts a smile to your face. It was cheesy at first, and it got it kind of nauseating and annoying the story. But when you see that it actually is bringing community together and everybody's got a smile on their face, they're having fun about this pet alligator in the Humble Park Lagoon. It's kind of warms you on this hot summer night. Thanks, Don. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman as we wrap up tonight's show on language. Avery R. Young and the Deacon Board in our performance studio tonight. Performed some songs. Heard from him in the last segment. Let's get one more song. This is one that's appropriate for what's happening in Chicago. And this is called Lead in the Water.
One, two, three, and. This is Lead in the Water for Flint, Michigan. Water. Yeah.
to the children. Oh, they knew and just kept playing God with water. Now they did nothing. Did nothing for the children. They did nothing. Just kept playing God with water. Now they say they gonna fix it. They say it for the children, but I don't believe it. To try like God with water.
Camp, y'all.
Charlie playing God with water. Every day Charlie playing God with water. Charlie keep playing God with water. Hey, Charlie playing God, y'all, with water. Hey, Charlie playing God, my Lord, with water. Hey, Charlie playing God. He playing God. He playing God with water. Charlie playing God with water. Hey, hey, Charlie playing God with water. Y'all right here, y'all. Charlie playing God.
Wow. Yes. Avery R. Young, the Deacon Board in studio, lead in the water. An ode to Flint, Michigan. What a song. What a performance. Avery R. Young and the Deacon Board. You can see them all over town. Avery R. Young's new collection of poetry is called Neckbone. The album for the band is called Tubman. Wow. Great performance tonight here on Extension 720. We'll take our break here and we'll come back and we'll wrap up on Extension 720. Stay with us. Elton Jim coming up 10 o'clock tonight. Treat. 312-981-7200, the phone number. Programming notes galore. I got to get my sleeping bag out. I am hosting the Steve Cochran Show tomorrow morning. 6 o'clock start. A little crosstalk with Dave Ennett and Steve Grzanich. Nice little start, Mary Vandeville. It's good to, you know, for maybe some new listeners to the station. Pete and I were both on the Steve Cochran Show for a good year. It was a year.
Almost.
And we had to get up at the ungodly hour to come in and do morning radio. Now, you know, that's the best time to do it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's prime time. It was a blast. But it was also, it made your head spin.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't do too many where I would do a show and then turn around and do the morning show. I did it last week because we got called in for the postponement of a
right, yeah,
Sox game. But yeah, so big show tomorrow morning. Kick it right off. I'm excited. We've got great people. Gary Chico's going to be on.
Great.
Betsy Ziegler from 1871 will be in studio.
Wow.
And we've got the MVPP and much, much more. Chuck Todd joins us. We can ask him about, what do you know about Jeffrey Epstein? I feel like we don't have enough Jeffrey Epstein talk on Extension 720, so I just wait till Chuck Todd comes on, right? It seems like the idea. But yeah, it'll be a fun show tomorrow. Dave Ennett, we can ask him about how, and I'm sure they've already gone over it, so I always feel like when I jump in, I'm like, oh, hey, Dave, how was it being the Grand Marshal of the Skokie Parade? No, we've already talked about that.
The there is a run coming up that I'm going to be doing in Evanston. It's like the run for Randy Walker. Remember Randy Walker?
Yeah. The football coach. Yeah.
I think it's not, whatever. But it ends on the Northwestern football field.
Oh, that's great. Where you've been to the practice.
Yeah, I've only been to the practice.
Yeah, that's cool.
So I ask him if he's involved in
that. Oh, yeah.
A Mr. Cat, right. Will you be there? Will you be running?
Yeah.
Right.
I want to find out. See if you can... I'll just call in.
Call in.
Get the request line. See if Joe, Super Joe, will put me through.
Yeah, right. So I'm doing the show tomorrow and then back here tomorrow night where we've got a great show lined up. We're going to talk... we went out, Pete and I, we talked about it yesterday, but we went to Eggers Marsh, which is the... It's in Calumet area. It's right, pretty much right under the Skyway. Mm-hmm. And... You know, it was about this restoration, this wetland restoration project that they've been working on for years. And it's been in the news because there has been threats to cut it. The president came when he took over, you know, wanted the EPA to, there were talks about cutting it back. But the Great Lakes restoration is important. This is a part of it. And it's about getting the flow of the cycle of water back to its natural state. A long time ago, I would say, 50, 60 years ago. We messed it up, and they put a Nike missile site and cut off the wetland from the lake, and because of that, it totally messed with all the migratory birds. It messed with everything that's down in that area that was important to the environment and to the habitat. And now, after all these years, they're trying to right that ship because they have a lot of flooding. They have a lot of things that's not supposed to happen there. Because of what we did man-made, not just the cutting off the marsh from the lake, but the industry and pollution down in that area. So we'll talk. We went there. Pete and I went there. Pete got his shoes ruined.
Yeah. Ruined my shoes.
That's on you, though. Because I had this, I'm wearing the same pair of shoes today. I just was very nimble. I was like a reindeer. I was like a little deer, a little fawn jumping around, missing mud parts because it was a little bit wet out there.
I'm slopping through.
You're like slopping, you're not even paying attention. Then you get, oh, what happened? Oh, my white shoes. Oh. Not me. I'm dancing around. I look like I was in a Nutcracker.
All the mud's on in your car, though, so joke's on you.
Joke's on me. Yeah, I guess. And then. My old car.
We should have planted an alligator at that Eggers Marsh.
I feel like now the opportunity to ask all the guys who were involved in that to say, are there any alligators in is lost because we taped it a while back, right? is this a good place for, I don't know, an alligator? And you and I just laugh and we giggle. We just think we're so funny. Because that's anyway, back to the herons. So that's coming up tomorrow. And also we'll have another one of our neighborhood tours. We'll go to Albany Park, which is an interesting area, northwest side neighborhood, classic. It's considered one of the most diverse neighborhoods, not only in the city but in the country. I think its competition is West Rogers Park. But Albany Park has always been a very diverse place. It's got its share of gentrification issues and crime and things of that nature. But it's really just about, I think the biggest issue I found from the conversation we had with Elizabeth Gomez was that they don't really know where the boundaries are at. Nobody knows where the boundaries are. And it was funny because I ran into Eric Zorn. And Eric Zorn, I said, where do you live again? He's like, in Albany Park. Well, you know, some say that he like switched it around. He was doing the same thing we were talking about. I'm like, yeah, there's a long argument about what the actual boundaries are to this neighborhood. A neighborhood that if you follow the boundaries, meaning the river and Montrose, would include Rod Blagojevich. And all of that, remember all the helicopters and the perp walks out of the house and all that kind of stuff was happening in Albany Park in Chicago.
Yeah, all the cameras watching him come out for a jog.
He jogged. Now, did he stay in the neighborhood when he jogged? I don't know. He may have crossed over. You just don't know. So that'll be tomorrow night here in Extension 720. And then Friday, which is crazy, as we just keep the train going. Friday morning, I'm in for Steve again at the big Naperville block party.
That's going to be a blast.
Yes. Again, one of the coolest things possible, Pete, this idea of doing radio play-by-play for a parade. And this just doesn't get any better than that. I just don't know. I'm not sure that's ever happened. Do you go back to the beginning days of radio, the bygone era of 1930s, and they're like, okay, we're ready for the Thanksgiving Macy's Day Parade, and I am going to tell you what I see.
I want to say that Harry Shearer in like one of his comedy groups.
He did it.
Used to do that like in the 70s or something of the Thanksgiving Day
Parade.
They would
do it. Yeah. That's great, right? It's great. It's a great bit. I've always wanted to do parade banter, number one.
Yeah.
I think it's the coolest thing. And did you know? And now, there's so at the WGN Morning News does the WGN Morning News block party every year. And this year, we're broadcasting from it. And at the culmination of this block party, where everyone comes out, and there's games, and the different personalities do different things. They do a broadcast live from it. There's booths. There's everything. And they really take over downtown Naperville, right by the Riverwalk. At the culmination is a parade where they do a parade. I'm assuming Bozo and the whole crew.
Oh, yeah.
And where we're situated, where the Marlene showed me the grid. Actually, Bill Murdoch pulled out the blueprint, you know, to show me like we were robbing a bank, circling things. This is where you'll be. This is where the parade's going to go. But it's going to go right past where we're set up. So the 9 o'clock hour.
You got to put together a reel and send that to the people at the Thanksgiving parade, because
right,
I know you want to be part of that.
Exactly. It's easy to do TV, but can you call a parade on the radio? And I feel like a dry run. Like I need to practice it. You know, I'm only going to have tomorrow. Maybe tomorrow night. Maybe that's what we'll do tomorrow night if we get a second available in the show. I can dry run what my parade call will be.
Yes.
You know, we can sort of maybe look at a parade, maybe put a parade on the TV, and I can try to call it in just radio. So just you're just hearing me call a parade. But then you need to be the sidekick. I haven't decided yet because you've got the ultimate play-by-play guy in Dave Ennett. He's the ultimate, one of the best that ever lived, right? You have him. Maybe he does the play-by-play, and I'm the color guy. I'm the Fred Willard.
Yes.
Right? I just throw a couple jokes in. Ooh, look at that one. I like the color of that suit.
Yeah, that's it.
Right? And I can be the guy like, you know, the very interesting thing about this float, this is run on diesel. That kind of stuff could work, right?
Oh, Dave will be into that. Yeah.
Yeah, we can switch it up.
He's a parade veteran. Right.
Then Mary Vandeveld can go out and we can put her out and she can be the parade, like the Janet Davies, where you go down and she's interviewing the celebrities from ER that are on the in the car.
Are there any celebrities going to be in the Naperville parade?
I was just thinking in my head about watching the Columbus Day Parade one time where they put they broadcast it, which is awesome. And then they had, I think it was Janet, it was somebody who was actually with a microphone who was out there like as the car was going slow interviewing them, you know, the cast of ER while they're on the back of a convertible and it's moving and she's got to trot a little bit to catch up. I remember thinking that was hilarious. It's a great bit, right? Do that bit. Mary Vandeveld, she can walk along and interview people while the parade is happening.
What time is the parade?
It's 9 o'clock.
Oh, so the last hour is
the last hour on Friday.
I can't wait.
It's going to be such a great broadcast. It's going to be so much fun. So, yeah, a lot of Justin. So I this gives you time to, I would say, rest now. I mean, listen to Elton Jim, and then Nick, and then I'll be on. So I don't know where you can rest, because there's going to be a lot of Kaufman coming at you in the next couple of days. Not sure you're going to be into it. For all the people who listen to the podcast Lower Wacker Live, which is my podcast, which Pete and I do every single day, we make fun of the news, so you don't have to. We have a lot of fun. Check it out at all. You can check it out on iTunes and Spotify and through WGN Radio. It's on the website, Lower Wacker Live, kind of a play on Lower Wacker Drive. No big deal. There's an alligator in the lagoon. Anyway, we're not going to be doing it for the next 2 days, just so I can go home and take a nap and then come back.
Yeah.
So I hope that works out for everybody.
And back Monday. Back at it Monday.
All right, we'll take a break here, and then Elton Jim will be here, and we will do a little crosstalk, and he will take over for us here on 720 WGN.